Okay, so first question, Chuck, a pretty obvious one. Why did you want to write a book about villains?
Well, you know, everybody does ask that question. I understand why. If I was in your position, I would ask the same thing. I always think to myself that I should, you know, I try to come up with some really kind of cogent, sort of insightful, meaningful response to it. But the fact of the matter is that when I start doing a book, I kind of just deal with whatever I'm kind of intellectually occupied with at the time, you know. And for whatever reason, about 3 or 4 years ago when I kind of signed this deal to do a nonfiction book and a fiction book for the publisher, I was very intrigued sort of by the idea of problematic characters. So, you know, I wrote that novel, The Visible Man, where the main character is kind of a consciously unlikable protagonist. And that sort of kind of naturally bled into this idea of doing an examination of the iconography of villains, both in fictional and non-fictional settings. Around the same time, I started writing the ethicist column for the New York Times Magazine. So I think, you know, I mean, the realistic answer is it was just sort of what happened to be on my mind.
Mm-hmm. And that was actually my next question, which you answered. Did the decision to write I Wear the Black Hat have anything to do with your work as the ethicist for the New York Times Magazine?
I started thinking about this book before I took that job.
Okay.
Although, I'm, you know, unconsciously, I'm sure that there is some relationship, you know, because, you know, in the past, my first book, say, was about, like, you know, hair metal bands, and I've written about a lot of television shows and a lot of rock bands and stuff like that. And I was always trying to get at, in at least in my mind, larger questions about audience and sort of the idea of, I guess, of storytelling and mostly just kind of the contextual of meaning of things that are not typically viewed as being meaningful in the present tense. And now, you know, I just kind of have kept going in that direction, I suppose, because now it's kind of all I write about. It seems like now it's everything I do has some relationship to the idea of what is reality and how much of that reality is a media construction.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. And I think that's what makes your work so interesting and timely. In the preface to I Wear the Black Hat, Chuck, you write about something that happened 25 years ago. Can you tell me about that?
Well, when I was in, I guess this had been about an eighth grader at the time, I didn't have a lot of money and I was really into heavy metal, but I couldn't afford a lot of cassettes. I only had 5 actual cassettes. The rest were all copies of albums that other people had dubbed for me. That seems like a really archaic subject now because of file sharing, but this is like how you used to trade music in the 80s. And I had a friend, an older kid, tape a record for me, and there was some space left over on the first side. So, of course, if there's space left over, you would just, you know, fill it with songs from other bands. And he put a song on by Metallica. They were covering a Diamond Head song called Am I Evil? And this older kid was really into this song. And, you know, probably not coincidentally, he had a really bad relationship with his mother because the song is about someone's mother being burned alive for being a witch. And, you know, it's this long song, and I was totally unfamiliar with it. And I wasn't the kind of kid who was disturbed by art very much, but I remember being disturbed by that song because it was confusing to me that somebody would aspire to be evil or sort of be excited about being an evil person. And, you know, I was probably misinterpreting the lyrics of that song. As an adult, you know, I've listened to it and it seems different to me. But I still feel that was a formative experience because, you know, I don't think I'd ever considered that question before, the idea of being evil consciously.
Right, well, wanting to be evil. And as you write in the book, that question that occurred to you when you were 14 years old is the same question you ask yourself today. But to my mind, it raises another question. Does a person always have the choice to be evil?
Well, you know, that is a real central problem with any kind of discussion like this is, you know, it seems as though I'm writing about newsmakers or film characters. But in a lot of ways, I suppose what I'm talking about is just that central problem over free will and the meaning of a life where free will exists or the meaning of a life where free will is non-existent. You know, if free will is non-existent, well, then calling someone evil is an extremely unfair thing, or even calling someone villainous is very unfair because they are essentially performing a destiny they had no control over. Yeah. If you add the element of free will in, you sort of are in a better position to make these judgments, except even if free will exists, I'm not sure how easily any person can access that. You know, we are socialized by the way we are raised. There's a biological imperative that makes us do certain things. If we have bad information, we're not going to be able to understand its weakness until much later in life. I think a central thing for me writing this book, because when I write these things, I'm kind of working through these problems in my own life in some ways, is the ongoing fear and kind of the escalating fear that I can't control my own thoughts and that perhaps no one can, and that maybe the great myth about being alive is that we're able to dictate how we think and feel.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned you can't control your own thoughts. Do you think why that is the reason that your work has this, to my mind anyway, your work has this real kind of stream of consciousness style to it?
Well, I that's maybe a little more intentional than it is organic. I mean, it sounds weird, but like when I'm working on a book, particularly during the editing phase of it, the thing I put the most effort into is making it seem like it's kind of effortlessly happening, even though that's, of course, not true. I mean, my hope is that when someone's reading the book, it will almost be like they are creating the book with their mind as they go along. Like the sentences are just kind of appearing one after the other, and they're actually building the book themselves with their brain. So, of course, if that works, and I guess I'm happy if it did, it seems as though I'm just sort of writing the thoughts as they kind of pour out of my head, but that's not really how it works. I mean, certainly anything that is written and published is a very conscious act. Like, there's nothing in the book that's accidentally there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. One of the fictional villains you write about, Chuck, is Snidely Whiplash, the cartoon villain that we know from the Dudley Do-Right segments of the Rocky and Bullwinkle show. And you say that no fictional villain can compete with Snidely Whiplash. Why not?
Well, I sort of start from the somewhat, I guess, comedic premise that there's just no more villainous act than tying a woman to the railroad tracks. One, because it's such an obvious extension of a diabolical act, and also because it's incredibly impractical. Like, there's not many less practical ways to kill someone than tying them to something and waiting for a train to come. And, you know, when I used to watch Rocky and Bullwinkle, really when I was probably too young to understand how well they were written. I was just watching it as a cartoon. They would go to these segments with Dudley Do-Right, and, you know, Snidely Whiplash, of course, is based kind of on this archetype from silent movies, but I hadn't seen silent movies when I was a kid. So to me, that sort of caricature of a villain was my first introduction to what a villain was supposed to be like. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he did not seem to have a purpose for his actions. I mean, we were talking about like free will and stuff like that. It was never clear why Snidely Whiplash tied women to railroad tracks. He just seemed to like to do it.
Yeah, it almost gets back also, yeah, the free will thing, and maybe he had no choice. It was a compulsion. And as you point out, it like tying a woman to railroad tracks is very labor-intensive. Is there any evidence, Chuck, that this is something that real-life villains actually did?
Well, you know, while researching this book, I did find out that it happened in Thailand not too long ago. There was a romantic dispute, and a woman got tied to the railroad tracks, and all the villagers were like, that's pretty crazy. back in time, you know, there were like, you know, documented cases. There was a college student in the early 20th century who was rushing a fraternity, and somehow part of his initiation, I probably shouldn't be laughing about this, was to get tied to a railroad tracks, and he got hit by a train. You'll find cases of this, you know. But for the most part, it was always sort of a media construction. Yeah. Like the real origin of this is from some like very early theatrical plays. It may be one of those things that we sort of accept as like a, you know, this this signature evil act, and it was never anything except a fiction. But of course, once a fiction becomes accepted, people start doing it.
Right, life imitates art. The woman in Thailand, was she killed, or did they? Was she able to be rescued?
She was killed. She was killed.
Yeah. I'm sorry to hear that. Now, you say that in any situation, the villain is the person who knows the most but cares the least. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, and also before I get into this, it's really not in any situation. I mean, that there are certain key exceptions to this, just like there is with anything else.
Okay.
But for the most part, I think that this is a pretty good guide for kind of figuring out kind of a unifying field theory as to why certain people are villainized. What seems to really bother people is not even necessarily the acts someone does. It has to do with the fact that someone who clearly knows better but has no emotional investment in the act and succeeds through their own ability to sort of, to manipulate people or to sort of, intellectually control other people without sort of an understanding of what the emotional toll will be. That's what really is upsetting to people. We've really been socialized to sort of believe that, and I think this is probably good, that you need to care about what your life means and how other people feel and how your life impacts that. And very often the villain is the person who seems to reject that. And now, this isn't that distant from people who talk about, say, psychopaths. The difference is, with a psychopath, they don't have the ability to make that choice. There's something wrong with their mind, and they act in a way that totally discounts the lives of other people. The villainous person does have that ability and chooses not to care. I mean, maybe that's even a simpler way to describe it. It is the choice not to make an emotional investment.
Mm, yeah. Can you give me an example?
Well, this guy isn't in the book, but I recently watched this documentary on Lee Atwater, and I wish he was in the book now, because in this documentary it discussed how this guy who was the architect of the Republican Party in the 70s and 80s and terrible things and really sort of changed the country in a negative way, had elected to become a Republican totally arbitrarily. He had no investment in the platform. He was just a young person who wanted to succeed in politics and understood the machinations of politics. So he looked at both parties and saw more ability to succeed as a Republican. The situation that happened with Penn State, for example, you know, we have someone like Joe Paterno. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good things in life. You know, if we discount what we learned about Penn State over the last few years, he's actually an example probably of what's good about college sports. But ultimately, he knew what was happening at his university and he chose something less important. He chose the sort of the stature of the football team over sort of the impact former defensive coordinator was having on kids, you know. It has to do sort of with both being in a position to really change things and choosing not to, not caring enough to sort of put yourself in a position where you will lose something you want.
Yeah, and in the book you write about the Joe Paterno funeral, and you specifically talk about Nike CEO Phil Knight and what he actually said at the memorial. Can you tell me about that?
Well, you know, when Joe Paterno died, it was, it was sad for multiple reasons. I mean, it's always sad when someone dies, but there was also this sense that, boy, it would have been great if he would have died a year ago, and he would have never had to experience any of this stuff, even regardless of his culpability. It seemed sad. So, of course, this guy dies in the wake of the worst scandal in college sports history, at least in America. And, you know, not many people are very willing to sort of express condolences on his behalf. But Phil Knight from Nike does. And, you know, he says that, you know, the person who, you know, the person at fault here is not Joe Paterno. It is, you know, the institution of college football or the witch hunt for Sandusky or all of these things. Well, later he went back and retracted that statement. But it was just sort of a very discomforting situation, no matter how you look at it. I mean, the one guy who's sort of supporting Joe Paterno in the wake of his death is also a guy who, like, pretty much set up sweatshops so 14-year-old kids could make basketball shoes for American kids that don't even play basketball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. One of the essays in your book is called Easier Than Typing, and you start this essay by presenting a thought experiment in which you ask the reader to imagine that Batman is real. Can you tell me about that, Chuck?
Well, I think vigilantes pose a particularly complicated scenario for people trying to understand how we kind of feel about public figures who are in the news. I mean, and I say that because if you talk to somebody who is, you know, intelligent, somebody who sort of is thoughtful, and you say, you know, is vigilante justice good or bad for society? They will immediately say, of course not. You know, we have these laws. We have a framework for how society works. You can't have people taking, you know, justice into their own hands. But then you give them a slightly more specific portrait of an incident that has happened. You say in a city that's sort of, you know, dominated by crime, a person who had done, you know, nothing wrong, was sitting by himself, is confronted by thugs, and he ends up responding with more violence than they brought toward him, and he sort of is acting on behalf of society, that society is fighting back. Well, then people immediately have their willingness to emotionally side with the vigilante just amplifies. And then it goes one step further. Whereas we sort of learn these details about the vigilante, what he or she is like, what their belief system is, the idea that this act may have been more personal than social, it swings back the other way. Mm-hmm. Then it's like this person isn't acting on, you know, behalf of the world. They're sort of acting as a rogue free agent. It has nothing to do with social justice. It has to do with a desire for bloodlust or whatever. So I was thinking, you know, about Bernard Goetz, because he's the clearest example of this, the subway vigilante in New York in the 80s. So I started thinking to myself, well, what if Batman was real? Okay. And when I say Batman, it's like, assume that there isn't this pre-existing knowledge of this character from DC Comics. It's, you know, no one knows who Batman is, so no one knows what his motives are.
Yeah.
I was trying to figure out how people would react, and particularly how the media would react if a figure like Batman actually came into play.
Yeah, and then that's where you go from, yeah, you go from that, from Batman to Bernard Goetz. And as you touched on earlier, Bernard Goetz becomes, even though he's a victim, he becomes, the more we find out about him, the more he seems like a villain.
Well, you know, and the initial reaction to those shootings was entirely in Goetz's favor. I mean, he was, mm-hmm. you know, for you know, about 3 to 4 days, he was, you know, like a nationally adored figure because, you know, New York was just a cesspool of violence at the time. And it just seemed as though that this is somebody who was sort of saying to the world, it's like, this is an unacceptable, you know, cultural status. We cannot accept our culture to be like this. But then when he was arrested and he started talking about himself and just showed no remorse over what he had done, and I guess there was maybe a social hope that he would be like, I hated shooting those guys, but I had no choice. And instead he was more like, it was easy shooting them. It was easier than typing, you know? Mm. Then we start going back into his own life and we realize he said sort of like, you know, racially insensitive remarks at a community meeting. And then we find all these strange details about his personal life. It turns out, for example, now he lives in an apartment in New York with a bunch of squirrels. He's become like an advocate for like the squirrel population of New York. Well, now he becomes marginalized as a character and we no longer see him as acting on behalf of anyone besides himself.
Mm-hmm. So there's this slippery slope, or there can be, between a vigilante and a villain.
Well, yeah, I mean, because we know all this stuff about Batman the character, we know Batman is good. We know his motive is based on the fact that, you know, he sees his parents killed and it changes him, it traumatizes him, and he decides that he doesn't want anyone to experience that kind of trauma. But if Batman were real, of course we would not know those things. We would just know that someone is dressing like a winged mammal going around beating people up who have not, you know, had due process. You know, it's like it would I think that a lot of the people, in fact, who probably like Batman the most as a character, the kind of people who are really, you know, sort of forwarding the import of, you know, the comic book mythology, would be the first people to say this Bat guy needs to be arrested. We need to get him off the street. He's worse than the criminals.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny when you said that you mentioned Batman as a winged mammal. I had this image given Bernard Goetz as being a squirrel advocate of being squirrel man. Now he could be a squirrel.
Yeah,
man,
I wonder what would have been the impact of that. I've always thought it was interesting that we don't see more examples of people trying to become literal superheroes. There are people who do this, you know, who dress up in suits and walk the street at night, but it would almost seem like that's such a part of our culture that it would become sort of a normative thing for crazy people to do.
Exactly. And I'd like to see more, and then we could have more. I'd like to see that happen with villains, too. That would be nice. Maybe I don't know who it's up to do it first. Maybe the villains have to initiate it. I don't know.
Well, you know, it's a real mistake if you're a villain, I guess, to become a supervillain because, you know, a big part of being a criminal is being unseen and not being caught. So, like, wearing Joker makeup does seem like a bad move.
That's
if you want to elude
good point.
Prosecution. Yeah.
But with the cult of celebrity we live in, maybe, you know, that's your 15 minutes of fame there. But that, yeah, that's a good point you raised, Chuck. There's an essay about Adolf Hitler in the book. And at the beginning of this essay, you say that you weren't going to write about Hitler. Why not?
Well, you know, in some ways, I thought, what could this possibly add to the conversation? I mean, there are some subjects in America that are – it's not even that they're like off limits, but they're almost more trouble than they're worth. You know, you don't in this book, very often, I take very sympathetic views toward villains. I mean, in fact, I consciously do so. I whenever I'm writing about someone problematic, my goal is basically to sort of first view their reality through what would be their eyes. Now, is it acceptable to do that with Hitler? Now, you know, it puts me in this position, particularly as somebody who's not Jewish, to sort of create maybe the misinterpretation that I am saying to people, hey, look, you got to understand where Hitler was coming from. And I didn't want to do that. So my idea was, I'm not going to write about Hitler. Maybe I'll mention him in passing here and there. But there's been enough scholars and writers dealing with this. So as I'm working on the book, I'm talking about it with various friends of mine. And when I mention that Hitler's not in the book, particularly the friends of mine who were Jewish were like, he's in the book. You got to put him in the book. You can't do this book without doing that. Mm. And I thought, well, boy, you know, maybe they're right. Maybe I'm just being scared here. Like, I'm, you know, you don't want to shy away from something that might be controversial. So I was like, you know, they're right. It's illogical not to write about Hitler in a book about villains. So I do this. And I give it to my best friend who is Jewish. And he's like, you better let your agent, who's also Jewish, read this piece. I don't think this is to your benefit to publish this. And I was like, okay, so first they told me, you know, you got to write about Hitler. And now everyone's saying, oh, man, don't write about Hitler. That's a mistake. You know, be careful. So what this essay ended up becoming is the problem of writing about Hitler in any context that isn't wholly negative or wholly sort of absurd. Like Hitler is such a placeholder for evil in American society that – It sort of, you know, it complicates it for everyone. I talk about a Bob Dylan song, you know, it's called With God on Their Side. And, you know, when you think about who can be, you know, what cultural figures in America are sort of beyond reproach? Well, I would say Dylan. If you know, I would say Bob Dylan is about as beloved and respected and credible an artist as we have. And what's interesting about that song is that when he writes about sort of, you know, the Holocaust, he's very clear in his message. He's sort of like, you know, it's crazy that we fought Germany and now, you know, Germany is believed to have God on their side because they're our allies. It's very clear. Then later in that same song, he talks about Pontius Pilate and Judas Iscariot and all these sort of, I guess, you know, like these, I mean, Judas actually, because, you know, and sort of the idea that well, you know, did Judas Iscariot have God on his side? And is that to say that you know, there's all these different ways that verse can be interpreted? And I just thought it was really interesting that, like, even Bob Dylan wants to be very clear about the way he feels about Hitler. Mm-hmm. But when it talks about any other character, he sort of has the freedom to sort of kind of create his own reality and doesn't really mind if he's misinterpreted. But you don't want to be misinterpreted in writing about Hitler. Mm-hmm. You do not want that to happen.
Yeah, yeah. As you write in the book, you have to be interesting without being interesting, and that's a tough thing to pull off, isn't it? Yeah. Well, one of the major themes that comes up throughout I Wear the Black Hat is this idea that as a person grows older, they feel and understand the idea of a villain more intimately. Can you give me an example of that?
Well, the example I use, and it's a short part of the book, but I do think it's a pretty good encapsulation of this, is the relationship people have with Star Wars, the film. You know, if you see that movie when you're very young, when you're 7, 8, 9 years old, you know, the character that inevitably you relate to is Luke Skywalker, who is a purely good person.
Yeah.
He is heroic. He's almost naive in his – well, he is naive almost in his desire for goodness. And you know, the world is not complex to Luke Skywalker. There are good things and there are bad things and there is no gray, you know. And as a little kid, that's how you are because you're really sort of aspiring to become a good person. Then you move into your teenage years, you know, or maybe a little younger, 11, 12 perhaps. And the character you start liking the most is Han Solo because Han Solo seems bad but is fundamentally good. He has the trappings of, like, the bad boy, I suppose, or kind of the anti-authority figure, the anti-hero, however you want to look at it. But you know ultimately he's good. So it's almost like a perfect situation. You get to create the illusion of being problematic while knowing that, you know, at your heart, your goal isn't that different than Luke Skywalker's.
Yeah.
But when you become an adult, when you fully mature, you know, you're no longer looking at these characters as like aspirational role models. You're just kind of comparing them to the person you have become. And once you are an adult and you realize that that you're not building a character, you are yourself. You see someone like Darth Vader and suddenly that seems like the person you relate to the most. You start seeing your own flaws in this, you know, this individual who is perceived as being totally bad, and yet you know that, you know, inside, like, his robotic shell, he has sort of the same human vulnerabilities and frailties as anyone else. And I think that this is sort of what, you know, when you asked me earlier why I wrote this book, I mean, I suppose this is a big part of it. You know, it's like I'm 41 now, and I just realized as I've matured that the world has become a more confusing place to me, and I feel as though I'm unclear about whether or not I am a good person. And I think that probably draws me to be interested in people who are supposed to be bad.
Mm-hmm. And you think that's true of other people? I know it's hard. You can't really put yourself inside other people's heads, but I wanted to ask you, is that, like, the fact that we – or, you know, some of us may become more attracted to villains as we age, what that says about us?
I don't know. You know, I am not one who, like, tries to figure out what other people will like. I feel like that's just a losing game in terms of writing. I just try to write what's interesting to me and hope it's interesting to other people. I think any time in my life, particularly as a journalist, when I've tried to write something that I thought people wanted to read, like I felt like there is a desire from the audience for this idea to sort of exist, you know, that always fails because people can tell it seems false to them. You know, it's like it's like trying to be controversial on purpose. That never works. People see through that immediately.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Chuck, can you tell me about your own arch enemy, Rick Helling, who you write about near the end of the book?
Well, I had this incident happen when I was in, but I guess again around eighth grade, the same time I heard that Metallica
important
song.
Time
it must
for
have been
you.
A formative
yeah.
period. Yeah.
Yeah,
it was a basketball camp in Fargo, North Dakota, and there was a kid at this camp named Rick Helling, who was, at least in our age group, by far the best player. He was just physically imposing and more skilled and very talented, but at least from my perception at that time, an awful person, maybe the worst person I'd ever met. He was extremely egocentric, and he seemed obsessed with sex, which I know is a normal thing for an eighth grader, but I just found it very uncomfortable. And you know, he didn't listen to the coach, and he was always arguing with the referees, and he was just kind of a bullying figure. And you know, and I it really stayed in my mind, you know. And then I remember him going to high school. He went to different high schools. He went to a Catholic school in Fargo called Chandler. And I was kind of a, you know, a small town, but you know, he was a good athlete, so his name was in the paper. And then, you know, he ended up becoming a Major League Baseball player, which is the only Major League Baseball player I've ever known personally. So I follow this guy's career, and I can't get, you know, I still feel the same way I did in junior high. So, like, I'm reading the newspaper hoping to see that Rick Helling got shelled. Like, I'm just waiting for him to fail. He wins 20 games one year, and I'm just so disappointed. And he pitches in the World Series, and I'm mad the whole time. Well, I read a piece for Esquire basically about this where I make this passing reference to having this arch enemy. And you know, and then he retires, and I'm like, oh, well, I guess end of story, you know. But then I find out years later, reading an issue of Time magazine in the dentist's office, that Rick Helling, this guy who I'd spent my whole life sort of viewing as, you know, the antithesis of me, my arch enemy, you know, was pretty much the first player in Major League Baseball to stand up and take a stand against anabolic steroids. Like, no one listened to him, but he was the first guy to be on record going like, look, this is a problem. It's screwing the game up, and there's going to be consequences if we don't step in. And then, of course, now, in the wake of what has happened, everyone looks back and go like, oh, you know, Rick Helling was this truth pioneer. So I just, you know, had to come to the realization that the one person I am on record for hating is probably one of the most important baseball players of the last 40 years, despite the fact that his success on the field was very marginal. His import was that he refused to allow something that was wrong to continue happening without sort of standing up and saying, we need to change this. So, you know, that's kind of my life. Like, the people I hate end up being the heroes.
Yeah, exactly. And that, as you write in the book, then that makes you the villain.
In my own story.
In that story, you are the villain. Yeah. The last line of your book, Chuck, is I wear the plaid hat. And it's a very evocative image. And it raised a question in my mind. Don't you think that most villains would say the same thing, that they're wearing a plaid hat rather than a black hat?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's, you know, because the villain who says he's wearing the black hat means he's being a villain on purpose. And that's not the same. Yeah. That's like the, you know, the hip hop band NWA or the Oakland Raiders or, you know, Lars von Trier, I write about. These people who sort of want the baggage of being a villain because it helps their art or it helps their product. It gives them an advantage. You know, that makes it almost theater. Like they're just painting themselves as a villain on purpose for some benefit. I think the real villain doesn't view it that way. The real villain is just like, I'm complex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Has writing this book and your work as the ethicist for the New York Times Magazine changed the way you think about good and evil?
Well, you know, has it changed the way I think about good and evil? I mean, you know, I'm not exactly sure I really believe in the concept of evil. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's good and bad, but evil is something different. Being the ethicist has definitely changed my life, though. You know, if I, like, you know, when you take that job, like, I'm not claiming to be the most ethicist ethical person in New York or in America. Like, the title of the job is the ethicist. It's just the name of the column. But I know it's not perceived as that way. It is perceived by other people as someone saying, I know what's right and I know what's wrong. So I'm super conscious of all my actions now. I was walking down the street the other day, and I was eating something, you know, and I had like a wrapper, and I rolled up the wrapper, and I tried to throw it in the wastebasket, and I missed. And, you know, I kind of kept walking, and then I was like, I better not do this. If someone sees this, I'm going to get fired. So I went back and I put it away, you know. Like, I'm always very nervous now of being seen as an unethical person. But, you know, that's not the same as being good, and that's part of the problem. Like, if I go through my life making sure I only do good things, but my motive for doing so is just to be seen as not bad, I don't think that's the same as being good for society. That seems like acting all the time.
Yeah.
And I sometimes wonder if my good deeds are basically just performances.
Do you really think that, though? You sometimes wonder, but do you really think
I don't
that
think
that
I know.
No?
I don't think it's possible for me to know. Hmm. Because, you know, there's so much, you know, everybody, there's so a big part of sort of living a reasonable life is self-deception. You know, we are constantly self-deceiving ourselves into believing that what we're doing is just or important or meaningful, you know, that it almost becomes – well, it does. It becomes a second nature. It's almost like there's a shadow self that is constantly convincing us that what we're doing is being done for the proper reason or the proper motive. And I'm very distrustful of the things that I do. Mm. You know, I try to be a generous person. I'm suspicious of my generosity. You know, try to be an honest person. Why? You know, am I just trying to avoid, you know, am I honest in a way that avoids a straightforward lie, but is just like a twisted version of the truth that gives me culpable, you know, I can't be accused of straightforwardly making something up. I don't know. You write a book like this because probably you're uncomfortable with your own self. And I think that's probably true about myself.
Hmm. Great. Okay. That's excellent. That's a great place to leave it, Chuck. Thank you. That was wonderful.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on.